Welcome to the New Zealand Tech Podcast, presented by Paul Spain and Anne Kiss.
Welcome to the New Zealand Tech Podcast. This is episode number 74. You're with myself, Paul Spain.
Nate Dunn.
And Sim Ahmed.
Welcome along, Sim. Great to have you here. First time on the show.
Yeah, great to be here. I love this awesome office you're in.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Now, tell us a little bit about what you do. You're a reporter for Computer World, right?
Yeah, I write for Computer World and CIO Magazine, so mostly enterprise IT and stuff, but sometimes I have things that go into PC World or reseller news and things, so a lot of variety.
Excellent, excellent. Well, thanks for joining us as we dive into a few topics tonight. Now, probably the top of the list today, really the freshest news off the wire, really, has been around Apple and a whole bunch of announcements from their Worldwide Developers Conference in San Fran today.
Yeah, so we've got quite a few things, especially around the next OS for iPhone and iPad, and also on Mac. So Mountain Lion will be released in July. There's no real date yet, but there are a lot of interesting updates to that, like the integration of Facebook and iCloud, and also all the features that you see in iOS being brought into the Mac, you know, framework.
Yeah, I think I've been playing around with Mountain Lion for two or three months with the developer versions, and yeah, looks like a really good update. And it's interesting just the extra announcements that they've made today there, as you mentioned, around Facebook and so on, which is interesting because, you know, it was last year with iOS 5 where Apple brought in the Twitter support, and that was, you know, I guess Apple starting to get into bringing that integrated social networking capability into iOS. But it was really odd that they started with Twitter and didn't have anything happening with Facebook. But they've now kind of filled that gap, across their product range, right? Or they will do once the new products launch.
I don't use any Apple products, so I'm pretty much a noob when it comes to the whole technology. Is it reasonably easy to upgrade from, say, iOS 5 to iOS 6? Is it just a download and install and away you go? Or, like, how do you actually...
Well, I think there's a little bit of a... how do you put it? I guess in theory, yes, the updates are easy, but I think results may vary is probably a fair sort of note to put next to that around iOS upgrades. What are your thoughts on that,
Sam? With iOS, so that's iPhones and iPads. When I moved up to 5. There were a lot of issues around the tweets, and it wouldn't send links properly. And I guess you'd always have to kind of wait until iOS 6.01, you know, until you get something stable. I'm more interested in the Mac Mountain Lion update, and because you have to be on Mac OS 10 Lion and have the Mac App Store in order to go onto Mountain Lion, and then you have to buy it for $20. And I'm just kind of interested to see what happens there. And whether we'll see the similar problems we saw with people going into Lion, all the bugs and the patches that came after that.
Yeah, well, you know, what we've been seeing over the last few years, really, because Apple are so regular with their operating system updates, both on the iPads and iPhones and on the iMacs and MacBook Pros, is that there's probably more pain points than what we see with, for instance, say, Windows upgrades, which swing around every 3 years. You know, they test them with so many millions of users. We just seem to get a few of those pain points. As you say, sometimes it's worth waiting for the sort of 0.01 update so they've ironed things out. And, you know, we just seem to get regular stories of people that tried to do the upgrades or, you know, they've gone through the automated update process and everything's turned to custard in one way or another. So, yeah, it is worth being cautious, but each of these updates usually brings some really cool features and, pretty quickly, you know, most people are running on those updates. And in fact, I think that was one of the points that Tim Cook pointed out, was that, you know, it's interesting that, the very large majority of Apple users using their mobile devices are running iOS 5, whereas Android, now they've had their new version out for a similar time with the version 4 and Ice Cream Sandwich, and their published stats are 7% of users, which, I guess is something that's been talked about a lot in terms of how difficult it is to you know, to bring all devices up to the current current version of Android.
I think this. I was reading a blog post, and I'm just trying to find the resource at the moment. But it was showing that mobile data, I think just recently on the last quarter, this is the first time that mobile data and desktop data have, you know, come together and they're bang on. So as you see, mobile data is going up and desktop data is going down. So, you know, all these updates are really taking advantage of the fact that we're doing a lot more on our mobiles. For example, you know, a couple of podcasts back, we talked about the new ASB app, and I'm actually finding that I don't log into ASB banking anymore because I can do everything I really need from my phone, and it's so much quicker. So it'd be interesting seeing not only with the Apple sort of ecosystem, but also Android, to see with people using their phones more and more and smartphones becoming more prevalent, how these are going to have an effect on, say, these platforms in a year, you know, 3 years, 5 years.
I think we can kind of see some of that right now with Apple integrating the Facebook things. It's kind of interesting that they're also bringing doing their own map program with the 3D flyover maps with on iOS. So they're taking these apps that were using third-party apps and they're integrating it into their own system. And they're probably going to have a better use and time of it because it's all integrated. But at the same time, I'm kind of feeling for these developers who are building these apps that are kind of being pushed aside because Apple are
edged out.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that's been a story for a long time with operating systems, as you know, the operating systems tend to get more and more powerful. Even back in the DOS days, with the later versions of DOS, they included a disk compression capability, and you know, in fact, there are a whole lot of lawsuits around it, as I recall. And, you know, that was stepping on the toes of, I think it was Stack Electronics that did this disk doubling sort of technology for, you know, for DOS. And there were other ones out in the market as well. And suddenly, oh, this product's of, you know, little relevance because it's built into the operating system. And, yeah, we've seen the same, I guess, on desktop operating systems for a long time, you know, in terms of Mac and Windows as well. So
continuing that thought, you're seeing because you know, this morning TomTom announced, so you can already get, there's a TomTom app for the iPhone. So TomTom's announced that they're partnering closely with Apple to actually provide the native mapping on iOS 6. You know, these developers, you know, I'm thinking about something like Navman. You know, you really have to look at partnering and end up being innovative, because you know, the marketplace for a Navman, why would you buy one when you've got a phone that can do it? You know, TomTom's got it down perfectly. Rather than sort of sitting there and just waiting for their market share to diminish, they're actually going through and saying, hey, you know, we've got we make really, really good maps. You guys make a really, really good phone. There's a perfect synergy for us to partner. So I think that's where developers, not just mobile developers, but developers in general, when they're going for the mobile space, really need to look closely at what they're doing and partner with, rather than saying that, you know, the actual manufacturer is a threat.
Well, that's an interesting one, and goes broader too, doesn't it, across a whole range of businesses, because, you know, any business today that isn't, you know, sharp and really looking ahead into the future might find itself as sort of, you know, replaced in a few years' time, you know, whether it's... I don't know, cafes in certain cultures where the Starbucks come along and roll into town and sort of you know, replace those concepts if the local cafes don't do something unique enough, or you know, we look at Kodak, who had built their whole business around producing film, you know, that's gone. As you say, the same thing's happening here, or you know, similar type of thing where the requirement for standalone GPSs and GPS apps just goes by the wayside. And we're already seeing that, I guess, on other platforms other than iOS, where you're getting really, really good, had really, really good mobile mapping capabilities and navigations. So
I suppose the thing that triggered my thoughts about mapping, and it's not just that announcement this morning between TomTom and Apple, is the fact I found my Navman the other day because I was looking through something else and saw it then. And, you know, thinking of the comparison between features with Google Maps on my Android is I can actually type in a name of a place and say, direct me there. Whereas with the Navman, I've actually got to know the address. And it seems like such a small little change, but it's massive in the fact that I don't have to remember where things are. I can just say, hey, Google, take me to, you know, say Starbucks Queen Street, and it will direct me straight there. Whereas Navman, I've got to know it's, you know, 100 Queen Street, whatever the address is. So, yeah, I think going back to my original point with these partnerships and stuff. I think it's exciting what TomTom's announced this morning, and it should be interesting to see how they integrate it with iOS 6. And that's probably as far as I can say because I don't know a lot about Apple. So,
well, it's good. It's good that we're seeing we're seeing great innovation still in this navigation space. And so we had Google with their announcement as well in the last week. I don't think we really chatted about that, but you know they're bringing out their sort of 3D flyover views, which they announced. I think that was late last week, wasn't it?
Yeah,
Sim?
I'm pretty sure it was.
Yeah. Yeah, and then you know now we've seen similar announcements from Apple, and you know Apple of course announcing their move, you know, which has been public for a little while, their move away from relying on Google for their mapping and navigation. Now the other bits that were announced today, I think there was a roundup of new MacBook Pros, and Apple of dumping the 17-inch screen one, which they've had 17-inch models now I think for about 10 years. So they've had a big screen laptop. In fact, I think they were one of the first, if not the first, to bring a 17-inch laptop onto the market.
Do you think that could be something to do with the new Retina displays and maybe the cost of trying to also have a parity with the 15 and the 13-inch with the Retina of a 17-inch display, do you think?
Possibly. I think part of it, the stats I saw, was that less than 1% of buyers were buying a 17-inch model anyway.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, Apple are very good at not having too many products in a particular range. And, you know, we look at other vendors and sometimes they've just got, you know, they've got so many different, you know, well, let's pick one of the bigger brands, HP. You know, they've got a lot of different laptop models. And if you compare that with Apple, Apple have got probably at any given time maybe six different machines you can order. Yeah, there might be some variations around disk and so on if you do a custom build, but very few machines overall. In fact, probably less than that, three or four. So Apple trying to keep it simple and not deliver obscure products that there's only going to be a small percentage of people buying. So
with the wider screen, and I had a much bigger laptop than I've got now, and it just, you know, it's supposed to be a laptop. It's not supposed to be a desktop that's got a screen attached. Whenever anyone says to me, is it? I'm a little bit biased in the fact I've got a dock at work, so I don't tend to work off my laptop all the time, so the screen size just doesn't make much of a difference. But my suggestion is that a bigger screen isn't always better, because you've got not only the, it's a lot bigger, it's a lot more unwieldy, but you've also got a weight. So if you're, you know, bussing all over the place, or you're doing a lot of walking, those extra few inches do add up to, you know, a few more grams, and that does start to be quite heavy when you're walking around for half an hour. So if you are looking at laptop, my suggestion would be if you don't need the bigger screen, go for something a bit smaller.
Yeah, well, I've been quite a big fan of the ultra portable sort of 12-inch screen type laptops for a long time, because when you're traveling, they're just ideal. There's not too much sort of weight to carry around. When you're at your desk, if you've got a dock, that works well. But yeah, you do ideally need a dock. And interesting you should raise docks before, Nate, because last week there were some announcements at Computex around docks that for the Mac, and we've now got a couple of products on the market that bring docking to the MacBook Pro platform.
Is there no... So
Apple don't provide any of those, and that's always been... You know, there's been, a couple of, frustrations for me working within, helping businesses with leveraging technology. One of the common things is people want the Mac because it looks great and so on. But then from a functionality point of view, we've always missed having a dock, which is usually a real requirement in a business situation, and they also haven't had a built-in 3G capability. And the other thing was the warranty support in New Zealand was really poor, although that seems to have really sharpened up recently. So they're heading in the right direction with those things to pick up the business customers as well, which is quite interesting to see. The docks aren't really probably what we're quite used to from for those who use a docking station for their PC, where you can just clip your laptop in and the power connects and the screen connects and keyboard, mouse, network, everything connects. They connect to the Thunderbolt port, so it does mean you still need to have a separate power supply that you connect and then plug something into the Thunderbolt port. What I'd love to see would be someone that, you know, realizes that the MacBook designs don't change too often, and actually develops some sort of a dock where you could, you know, sideways sort of slide your MacBook into it. I'd definitely get one of those for my MacBook if there was a nice easy way to dock that in that was designed specifically for the machine, and it wasn't still a matter of sort of joining cables up, which is what these new docks require.
Yeah.
So that's probably a... and the other bit was the new MacBook Pro, which has the Retina display. That was probably the really big one that I guess had been rumored for a good few weeks, if not months, that was coming. Sim, you've had a little bit of a look at the info that's come down around that one?
Yeah, so this is going to be for both the 13 and the 15-inch models of the MacBook Pro. But they're not going to be getting rid of the non-Retina versions. They'll have versions for both. The new versions, however, are almost at $4,000 in New Zealand. So it's a very expensive step up.
It's quite a price step at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah. And but the price for the normal versions will remain the same as the generations that are available right now. And I'm running the currently most modern MacBook Pro 13s, and it's a good product. And I don't see too much change in the new MacBook Pros, except for the that it will be standard to have flash drives for all of the devices, and also there'll be two Thunderbolt ports, and no more Ethernet.
USB 3, right?
USB 3 and 2 support on all the ports, but no Ethernet ports anymore. You'll have to buy the Apple dongles, which come with the MacBook Airs, which is quite annoying for me because I have no Wi-Fi connection.
What do you think about that?
I think they're trying to force that play into the market and trying to make that a norm, like they've tried with the MacBook Air. And I've used the MacBook Air Ethernet dongle. It's annoying to use. And like I was just trying to say before, I have no Wi-Fi connection in my room. I live in a concrete bunker, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
So I've had to use the Ethernet cable on my MacBook, and it's kind of making it a no-go for me.
Okay.
For a step up, yeah.
Yeah, okay, okay. Oh, that's an interesting one to see. And I guess we are getting used to having Wi-Fi everywhere, but there are still, you know, for performance reasons and coverage reasons, plenty of reasons to plug in. And I mean, usually I would plug in just to get that maximum performance too. What about you, Nate?
Yes, I would tend to plug in, especially I've done a few home installs for people where, you know, the typical, thanks Telecom, the broadband comes on one side of the house and the actual home computers on the other side, so it's a mixture of either wireless, and then you try to get through a whole lot of concrete walls, which is pretty much impossible. I had pretty good experience using HomePlug, which is when you run your network connectivity over power. Although it's, you know, and I'm not a massive power person, but it's got to be on the same phase, I believe. And then I've also had issues where if there's like a kitchen in the middle, it can tend to throw it out. But you really can't beat having a network cable, you know.
Proper genuine connection from one point to another, right?
It just works. You plug it in. You don't have to worry about the wireless dropping or someone, you know, someone's not going to be sitting there trying to hack into your Ethernet cable unless they're an Uber geek. It just, in my mind, it just works. But in a scenario, you know, where we're sitting around with our laptops and iPads and stuff, you know, wireless is much better because we're not having to have all these cables everywhere. So, you know, each one serves its purpose, so you just got to know what its limitations are and go with that. So
yeah. Now, interesting, you should mention the power plug technology.
Yeah.
That is something that has improved quite a bit over the last few generations. And it, you know, for listeners out there who are trying to work out how to connect up their home and don't want to rerun cables, it is worth giving that a go. I guess the frustration is if you go out and buy the equipment and you plug it in and it doesn't work, you could be stuck with it. So you need to look for a retailer that will let you take it back. And I've been through that myself, where I've bought the gear, plugged it in. Oh, actually, this doesn't work. And so then you need to go and run proper cables around your house. But it's, yeah, it can be quite useful for just getting from, you know, one part of your house to another.
Yeah, if you're trying to set it up, like whenever I've used them, I've always put both onto one power board and then tried to sync it rather than plugging one on one side of the house and running to the other, then coming back because it doesn't work. So you plug it into a power board, get them synced, get them talking to each other. The other thing is they don't work very well through power boards. Let's say if you've got a power board on one side and a power board on the other, they need to be plugged directly
into
a socket.
Wall.
which can also be a bit tricky because
they may not have enough.
Manufacturers don't make little plugs, and you can never fit two big plugs next to each other. And these home plugs are normally big behemoth things. So yeah, it becomes also a physical challenge as well. That's trying to each get them to sync. So you just got to be patient and persevere, I think.
Yep. Now in local news, you'd been writing in Computer World this week about scholarships for New Zealand game developers. Can you tell us a little bit about?
It's a partnership between Sheet Interactive, Pickpoc, which is a mobile game publisher in New Zealand, and also Media Design School in Auckland. And it's for their two new game developer courses, which will be the first semester will be from August this year. And $2,300 have been provided for two students to go towards these courses. And it's a really cool step up from going from a diploma to a bachelor's of game development. And I think it's great. Yeah, it's a great step towards software exporting from New Zealand.
Well, there's already quite a strong base of game developers here in New Zealand, including those you've mentioned and of course Small Worlds and we've had Mitch from Small Worlds here on the show a number of times, there just seems to be a lot of good game development coming out of New Zealand, and it's a huge opportunity for New Zealand to grow that. It's a great way to export our creativeness and our technology expertise, onto a global market.
Yeah, Stephen Knightley, who's the chair of the New Zealand Game Developers Association, he thinks there's about 25 to 35 game development studios of size in New Zealand. And at a recently held conference for game developers, there were about 300 people who attended. And it was really actually heartening to see that it wasn't just the stock standard game developer geek that was there. There were a lot of younger people, older people, and also a lot of women there as well, looking to find a career in this space. It's a very well developing area.
Yeah, that's great. Oh, that's really good to see. Now, also just of local interest, those who are interested in just keeping up to date with what's happening with ultra-fast broadband, the fibre rollout and so on that's happening around New Zealand. Orcon have been working on putting together some little breakfasts, I think in Auckland and Wellington, if I remember correctly. And they've broken that up. So this week there's one that's targeted around ultra-fast broadband in the home. Then they're doing a session on ultra-fast broadband for businesses, and another one for schools. So have a look up on the Orcon website if you're interested in going to those sessions and just finding out a little bit more about what's happening. And of course, Orcon have been putting themselves at the forefront of UFB or ultra fast broadband by being one of the first internet providers to offer ultra fast broadband plans across the country. Now, an interesting story that probably affects quite a few of us has been password leaks for LinkedIn and also eharmony.com over the last week. Nate, tell us about your experience there with eharmony. Oh, I mean with LinkedIn. Sorry, you won't be on eHarmony.
No, my significant other would be a little bit upset, I think, if I was on eHarmony. I've actually just Googled it because I actually had no idea what it is, and I know people think I'm lying, but I don't. I can't remember the name of the site, but someone booted up a site where you could type in your address and see if your password had been compromised, and mine had. I've had a LinkedIn account for yonks, and my password's a little rubbish, mainly because I don't really use the site often.
And did you get a communication from LinkedIn as well?
No, I didn't. I noticed when I logged in, there's a big banner at the top that says, please change your password. And I think as a developer, people need to understand that. So what was pinched was things called hashed passwords. So without getting ridiculously technical, when you create a password, there's a sort of algorithm that runs. It creates a sort of string of gobbledygook that no one can understand. So next time you go to log in, and let's say your password is test. Test is probably represented by a whole lot of characters. When next time you go to log in, you'll type in test. They'll use the same process to convert it into the unreadable characters. And if those characters match each other, then obviously what you've typed in, it matches your original password. Now, this one-way hash is a good way to stop, you know, if the database gets compromised, all the passwords aren't there in clear text, meaning, you know, most people tend to use the same password all over the place. One of the biggest criticism that LinkedIn had was the fact that they didn't salt their passwords, which means that they would take my password like test, they would have another phrase like, say, cat. They would then, instead of just changing it into unreadable characters or word test, they would actually add a password and their hash together, so test cat, and then send that through the database. So that it makes it a little bit harder, a little bit more complex. You know, a really good developer knows all this sort of stuff, so I'm quite surprised that LinkedIn got that. Having said it, you know, they've only got hashed passwords, so it's not like, you know, they're going to be able to decode, because you can't unencrypt hashes. They're one way. So,
but this, what this does is let those hackers actually narrow down the list of possible passwords that they could run through. So it still helps the hackers, but I guess not as much as some people are claiming.
Yeah, as a dev, I sort of saw it and thought, yeah, that's really annoying and very embarrassing too. Like, LinkedIn's supposed to be the site for professionals, and they're not even storing their passwords in sort of industry standard way. At least it wasn't credit cards, not pointing anything at PlayStation or anything, so multiple times.
I'm just looking online, and one of the sites that you can use to track down if your password was on this list is lastpass.com/LinkedIn. Don't worry, I don't think they'll steal your identity or anything like that. They're just checking if your password was on the list. So this is completely open, and they don't use your username at all in this process.
Did the I don't think were emails compromised? I think it was only passwords.
I think it was just passwords. Which, so not necessarily the email address. So,
which I thought was really strange. But you get these all sorts of silly breaches all the time. I remember reading on Twitter last week that Yahoo, I think it was the Android app, they had their private key, which is a big no-no, which means that people could sign SSL, which is, you know, when you go to log into your bank, you get the little padlock, that people could sign it on Yahoo because they were, you know, just being lazy and distributed it with an app, which is a ridiculously big no-no. So, you know, I suppose the argument comes back that we're all human and sometimes we do silly things when really we need to be really conscious about security, because there are bad people out there that want to do bad things with our data. So you just got to be careful.
And it's very easy for them to automate those processes. So, yeah, I mean, we do regularly talk about this on the podcast, but when these stories comes up, it is just a good reminder to have unique passwords across different sites and, you know, make those passwords long and complex. And you know, the most common passwords that come up are, you know, 123456 or password 1 or
QWERTY as,
you know, just really simple things like that, banana 54, or, you know, just a word and a couple and one or two numbers at the end. And those things are really easy to compromise, and they can be done automatically without you knowing, just because your username for any website is probably out there in a spam list somewhere. And if they just decide, all right, we're going to try and target this block of people today, then, you know, if you've got one of those simpler types of passwords or a password that's used across multiple sites, then there's a good chance at some stage you're going to get hacked. And, you know, I think for those of us sort of sitting around on the podcast tonight, each of us will know numerous stories of friends and you know, people we work with who have had a Hotmail account or a Facebook account or some other account that's been hacked in some form, and sometimes there are not very nice consequences of those happenings. Mostly we don't hear about too many bad stories, but yeah, nasty stuff does happen from time to time, so best to be very cautious.
If I can do a blatant plug of my blog, I actually just blogged about this on Monday, about how some sites, in my mind, have ridiculously complex password procedures. And there's an XKCD comic, which I can't say that I found it. It was actually another GeekZone user that found it. And they were talking about, like, his example is the four words correct horse battery staple. Now, let's say if you're doing a dictionary tact, which is pretty much where you run through every dictionary word and wait till the system eventually, you know, you crack it. You know, no one's ever going to come up with that four combination of word. It's going to take them so long. And at least it's stupid enough that it's easily memorable. rather than having to have a password that's got a capital, you know, a capital letter in it, at least a punctuation, a couple of numbers, and you end up just writing it down on your screen, which is really...
Yeah, going for long passwords is quite a good way to, you know, to deal with those complexity issues, you know, rather than having strange characters, for sure.
Yeah, so as a dev, again, it's about a balance between making it hard for the bad guys to get in, but also not making it too hard that your legitimate users have to jump through all these, you know, flaming hoops to get into your system.
Yep, that's definitely a good point. Now, just trying to think what the other sort of big highlights were, I guess, in the last week. There was a chunk of discussion we had last week around E3, the Windows 8 release preview, and also Computex. Now, you guys have been looking at some of these new laptops and tablets and so on. I think we were chatting earlier, Sim, about the...
Tai Chi.
Yeah, the Tai Chi. Now, sort of a little bit of a similar style name to Lenovo's... What was their one? And my mind has gone blank again. It'll come back to me.
ThinkPad, maybe?
Yoga, the Lenovo Yoga. Yeah. So there's sort of, you know, similar-ish sort of names there. That one was announced at CES. So what are the big points about the Tai Chi? I mean, specifically geared towards Windows 8?
It's a Windows 8 device. It's a Windows 8 Ultrabook, but it has two screens. One on the front where you'd have the normal laptop screen, but also on the lid on the back. And the one on the back is... a touchscreen with a 1900 by 1080 display, and that's quite an interesting look. It's kind of like those flip-top Windows laptops you used to have, which had a little tablet that you could kind of turn around.
That's right. You could turn the screen around, couldn't you? So what was facing you when you had your keyboard, you could flick it around and use it like a tablet.
Yeah,
but this does it without flicking the screen, right?
And also, if what they're saying is true, you can use both displays at the same time. I'm not sure what you'd do with both displays on at the same time or how much it would affect your battery, but...
What sort of head would you have to be able to see both sides of the screen at the same time?
I think you guys are getting this wrong. What you need is a mirror on one side and you're twice as efficient.
No, yeah.
Thanks for that, Nate. That's awesome.
That's how it works.
Or you could be playing Battleship with someone on the other side.
That'd be
perfect.
The
world's most expensive Battleship set.
Yeah, brilliant.
They've also announced a couple of Windows RT laptops. If you're using Windows RT, that's Qualcomm, NVIDIA, and Texas Instrument. These are ARM chips, and they're not running Intel chips. But these are quite different to the Intel version, which will be the standard Windows 8.
Well, I guess the big thing about RT is it's Microsoft competing directly with the iPad and with the Android tablets. So, you know, you'll run on those ARM chips that are common on both of those platforms. The limitation you get is you can't run all the older traditional Windows apps, right? But their big point of differentiation, as well as the Metro user experience, is... that those RT laptops will actually include within the price Microsoft Office. So, you know, people get that benefit of having the Microsoft Office apps that they're used to running. And, of course, you can hook into a keyboard and mouse, which, you know, iOS, you know, especially isn't really so geared up for being able to do that. You can't hook a mouse into your iPad, right? So...
Hey, how are you guys finding and thinking about the actual acceptance of tablets and stuff? How you, and answering my own question first, because I was having some discussions with a contractor that we use down south, and they're saying, you know, I'm seeing a lot of tablets here, and another client of mine's over in Canada at a big conference, and, you know, everyone's got tablets regardless of what platform. But he's saying, especially in the smaller towns, like, there's still the penetration's still not there. There's not a lot of people that are using them, and even, you know, people just sort of getting onto laptops now, so... What are you guys sort of seeing? Friends and family getting more familiar with the tablet and that sort of way of working?
I work a lot in the enterprise area, and I see that businesses, especially small businesses, are preferring tablets over buying laptops in their next, you know, procurement phase. You know, they're getting the tablets because, one, they can use it at home, and two, they can use it at work, and building that that convergence of work and home together on these tablets instead of laptops. But that's kind of in a very limited space. I'm not seeing it too much between other people, though.
Yeah, it's quite. I mean, I think it depends on what space you're in, and you know, there's certainly a segment of the market where you know, iPads in particular are really being quite highly adopted. But when you look at, you know, I guess broadly across New Zealand and even internationally, you know, you realise that these are still quite expensive devices for people to add in if they still have existing PCs and laptops. And so it tends to be that our upper segment of the market with a bit more money to dispose of that tend to be going for tablets. But I think over time that's going to change more. And, we see people taking on tablets today, but in most cases they don't entirely replace a PC or a laptop, because the functionality can't do everything that the PC or the laptop does. So I think as iOS sort of matures on the Apple side, Android the same, and now with Windows 8 sort of coming out, you know, we're moving into a time where tablets can do all of the fun sort of consuming content type stuff that we're used to today with tablets, but they'll also be able to replace the functions of our traditional computers. I would say that will be where they sort of really become mainstream, and that's probably going to take a year or two before we see that adoption pick up.
I think I'm also seeing, because I've got the Galaxy 10.1, that it, like the old days when you had the MP3 player, people would say, oh, is that an iPod? And I'm finding that with my tablet, and you just get, it's like, yeah, it is an iPad. You know, Apple's got such an, their marketing machine works so well that people just assume if it's a tablet that it's an iPad. And
I think especially if people are sort of non-technical, they don't understand all the various brands and products. Yeah. And I think when these Windows 8 tablets start coming out later on in the year, the devices look very much like an iPad. And I think the average consumer will call a Windows 8 tablet an iPad. Microsoft might not be too happy about that, but I think that's the way it's going to go initially.
I think they'll be happy if anybody's got a Windows 8 tablet in their hand, to be fair. Start with, at least.
Ooh. Well, very true. I mean, they would definitely be keen to get their product out there. All right, well, I think that probably wraps up our agenda for this week. So thanks, everybody, for listening in to the NZ Tech Podcast. Now, you can, of course, find each of us online, and you can find the NZ Tech Podcast online. So you can reach us at nztechpodcast.com, facebook.com/nztechpodcast. We very much like it if you choose to like us. And we're on Twitter, of course, as well, NZ Tech Podcast. Now, guys, how do we find you online, Sim?
You can read my articles on computerworld.co.nz, or on Twitter you can get me at Simantics. That's Sim Antics.
Cool. We'll look out for you.
And you can find my blog is either on the front page of GeekZone or my personal domain, natedunn.com points at it, or on Twitter, nice and short, just Nate.
Excellent. All right, thanks for that, guys. And, of course, you can track me down on Twitter, is at Paul Spain, and techjungle.com is my blog. All right, we will catch you all next week right here on the NZ Tech Podcast. See ya.